Good morning, good morning. I'm Joanne Bowman.
And I'm Dave Mazza.
And welcome to Voices from the Edge. This morning we have a program that we think you will find most interesting. Imagine being convicted of a crime that you didn't commit. Imagine that your sentence is death. Imagine constantly telling people, but it wasn't me, I didn't do it, I am not the one. And then one day, an organization takes on your case and is able to prove that you, in fact, are not the one who committed the crime. Imagine 18 years of your life gone because of a wrongful conviction. Well, that's the story we're going to hear firsthand today from one of our guests in the studio, Curtis McCarty. McCarty, is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Oh, yes, ma'am. I am not that old. Curtis has a story to share with you, and I think it's a story that is well worth listening to. We also are very pleased to have in the studio Ron Steiner, who is, are you with the sentencing, tell us who you're with, Ron.
I'm affiliated, I'm a volunteer with Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. It's okay. The nonprofit organization that's working on repeal.
Wonderful. And as always, we want you to be involved and engaged in this conversation, so feel free to give us a call at 503-231-8187. We'll look forward to your participation. So, Curtis, let's kind of set the stage. You look like a fairly young man now, so the fact that you spent 18 years behind bars clearly says that you were really young when you went in. So share your story.
Actually, I ended up serving a total of 22 years. In a nutshell, a young woman in Oklahoma City named Pam Willis was found murdered in her home. She mm-hmm. was an acquaintance of mine. Her father was an Oklahoma City police officer. Mm-hmm. I knew who she was. Right. She ran in the same circles. We were all drug addicts mm-hmm. and petty criminals. And mm-hmm. None of the people I knew at the time, and this included Pam, the mm-hmm. same was true of her, had an education. We were all high school dropouts. She was found murdered. The police by all accounts, did a very good investigation at first. There were 42 young men who were brought in for questioning, and I was one of them immediately after the homicide, just right. simply by the fact that I knew her. Mm-hmm. They took hair, blood, saliva, fingerprints, palm prints, a statement. They gave me administered a polygraph exam. Mm-hmm. Took my photographs, and at the end of the day told me I was free to leave, and I didn't hear from him again for 3 years. Mm. In 1985, the police heard a rumor that I told somebody that I knew who killed Pam, mm. which was sort of a half-truth. I had only repeated a rumor myself that it must have been her drug connection mm-hmm. because of the nature of the crime. It was just speculation. By 1985, the police had those intervening years to find out a little bit more about me and my character.
Right.
I wasn't a moral person at the time. I took no responsibility for myself or my family or my community. I thought I was smarter than everybody and could lead this wild life and skate by. Mm. They decided they didn't like me very much, I guess, and I suppose I don't blame them, but the second time I wasn't invited for questioning, but was taken by force. Mm. At the end of that long day, I was told by a representative of the district attorney's office that he thought I was lying, that they believed that I did know who killed Pam, mm-hmm. and he said to me, if you don't tell us who killed Pam right now, you'll take his place in court. I didn't know what to say to the man other than, I don't know. It was such a shocking thing to say to me. I didn't, to this day, I still haven't.
It's still hard to find an answer to that question.
Yeah, why, mm-hmm. how this man ended up in such a position and how, what made him think that he could say something like that or do something like mm-hmm. that. I didn't know, and as your listeners just heard, he kept his word, and I found myself standing trial for capital murder.
Mm. And so, I mean, there must have been some point during that interview that you're thinking, well, I didn't do this. So clearly we have a justice system that will figure all this out, right? I'll go to court. They'll figure out it wasn't me. I'll go home.
Yeah, that's correct. I had to sit in the county jail for a year awaiting that first trial.
Wow.
And as the trial approached, I was surprised that not only myself but my family were unafraid.
Mm-hmm.
We believed those things that we were that we're all taught in school, that we have a just and fair system, that we all get a fair shake in court, and
right.
that the police and the government are going to tell the truth.
Right.
That the judge is going to see to it that things are, you know, progress in an orderly and fair fashion.
Mm-hmm.
That we'll get a fair jury of our peers.
Right.
And so I went into the process with a high degree of confidence that everything was going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about 2 days into the trial I realized it wasn't going to be okay.
How old were you?
22.
So you were a baby.
Yeah.
Wow.
So was there any point in all of this where it, you know, the government at least gave an indication they were trying to just hardball you into, you know, taking a plea for a lesser offense? Or was it they were, from the get-go, trying to nail you for this crime you didn't commit?
Well, as I said, they got it in their heads that I knew who did it and mm-hmm. wouldn't tell.
Mm-hmm.
They did attempt the plea bargain three different times. I was actually tried for this three times. I kept winning my appeals based on misconduct
wow.
committed by the prosecution and a woman named Joyce Gilchrist in the police department, who was their forensic chemist.
Right.
I would go back to trial, and they would simply repeat that same bad conduct, and it would get reversed again. So this just kept playing out for years and years. But they did, at each trial, offer a plea bargain that if I would plead guilty to the crime, I would receive a life sentence.
Mm.
1 year before I was released, after the case had been reversed for the third time, with a multi-agency joint task force investigation and the Justice Department investigating, they came to me with a last deal.
Mm.
1 year before I was released, they told my attorneys that if I would plead guilty, I could walk out the door right then, time served.
Wow.
And
well, at that point, you must have thought, right? I'm like stuck in this like nightmare, right?
Yeah.
So why not just say, okay, if I get to go home today, I did it.
No.
And why not?
Didn't do it.
You make that sound way too simple. So at the trial, I mean, was there eyewitnesses? Did somebody sit on the witness stand and point at you and say, that's the guy I saw leaving the crime scene?
No.
So clearly the police experts came in and said, we found his fingerprints, we found some evidence that absolutely says that you were at this place at this particular time when the crime happened.
That's exactly what they did.
That's what they said, but that wasn't
mm-hmm.
true. Okay. Which is why the appeal.
Well, that's one of the key issues that mm. Had people on the outside interested mm-hmm. in what was going on from
right.
the very beginning, is because they could provide no explanation.
Right.
What they told the jury was that the evidence collected at the crime scene was damning and that it all pointed to me. Therefore, I must have been the killer. What they didn't have an explanation for is if that was true, why didn't they arrest me 3 years earlier?
Mm.
They had no explanation for that 3-year mm-hmm. gap.
Wow.
And that's where they eventually got caught
mm-hmm.
because they had to go back and falsify their status reports for this unsolved homicide for mm-hmm. 3 years. They went back and falsified those documents. They hid the fingerprint files.
So I'm curious. So is this because the person who was killed was the daughter of a police officer, and by golly, somebody had to pay for that? Or do you think that this is a much more pervasive problem, or at least that during that time?
Both.
Both.
There was a period in the early 80s where the whole get tough on crime program mm-hmm. was sweeping across the country.
Oh,
and
yes.
We're going to take back the streets, as
That's
they
right.
said. And unfortunately for the people of Oklahoma and Oklahoma mm-hmm. City specifically, there were a few people who got into power who were corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
your listeners can look up this man named Robert Macy on the internet. He became the prosecutor in Oklahoma County for 2 decades. He was corrupt, violent. He simply didn't care whether you did it or not, and he has secured the most death penalty convictions of any prosecutor in America, and most of those were had by nefarious means. He simply didn't care. It's not my opinion either. The appellate record is replete with evidence of the appellate courts hammering him over and over and over for misconduct, but they would never sanction him, so he would go back and repeat that same bad conduct.
Wow, if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Curtis McCarty, who was wrongfully convicted of a murder, spent 18 years on death row, a total of 22 years incarcerated, and you were released when?
In May of 2007.
May of 2007. And so we're having a conversation about his story and how this is possible in a country that prides itself on having a criminal justice system that is supposedly fair and impartial and supposedly works for us all. And so it must have been devastating to, you know, to file the appeal, to win the appeal, and then have to go through another whole trial all over again. Did you do that 3 times? Is that what happened?
Twice. Third time it was just a resentencing, but it's basically the same process.
And so I guess, I don't know, I'm still a bit confused, right? Because it's like, okay, so if there's no physical evidence, there's no eyewitnesses, I just can't imagine how you can make a case in court. I mean, I can imagine, actually, I take that back. 22-year-old kid in the courtroom, just assuming that, you know, the justice system works the way it's supposed to work. And then experienced prosecutors, experienced police officers that know what it takes to have a conviction. So I, as soon as I said that out loud, I thought, no, I can picture this. I can definitely picture how this works. And so I think I want to fast forward a bit, and then we can come back and talk a bit about the story. But I want to understand, and I want the listening audience to understand what happened in May 2007. You find out that you're actually about to really leave. You didn't take that last plea bargain that would have put you on the street. Tell us about that process. What happened in May 2007 that actually allowed you to go free?
Well, it's actually more involved than that.
I'm so shocked.
By the mid-1990s, we have their internal memos now.
Right.
They realized that they had a problem with this woman in the police department. They were going to have to do something. She was tarnishing their reputation.
Ah.
So they fixed the problem by promoting her.
Ouch.
Ah, good traditional way.
Ouch.
Yeah.
One of the last things that this woman did in her official capacity as a forensics expert testifying in court,
right,
in felony cases was against a man named Alfred Mitchell, one of my neighbors on death row in Oklahoma.
Right.
They collected the semen samples from the rape murder, sent it to the FBI in Washington, D.C. for DNA testing. The sample was good, the test was good, and the results were valid. The result was negative, not him.
Wow.
In 98, a federal court ruled that Joyce Gilchrist, this woman from the police department, with the knowledge and participation of the Oklahoma County District Attorney, changed the answer.
Whoa.
From negative to inconclusive, took the stand and said that the biological evidence collected at the crime scene matched Mitchell, therefore he must have been in violent contact with the victim at the time of her death, and it was perjury.
Whoa.
So there was an investigation launched. After all of these years of wrongdoing against these men and women in Oklahoma, this time they falsified a federal document, and the FBI came knocking at the door of the police chief. And it began to unravel, and that was the official investigation began in 2000, and is ongoing. There is still a federal grand jury sitting in Oklahoma City hearing evidence on these matters. I was running out of time. The state had killed all my friends.
Wow.
I grew up, you know, when I went in, I was a fool. I was a young man. I was immature, and I had to grow up in prison, and I met all these other young men who were in the same position. They were just young and foolish and drug addicts, and most of them did commit homicide in one capacity or another. But the stories that we hear about prison are true. You have to make friends and you have to protect yourself from predators and from the staff too. So all my friends were dead. I was running out of time. And then I get this newspaper clipping from my mother that says that the FBI is investigating that office.
Wow.
And I finally had, after all of them long years, this glimmer of hope that I might go free. The investigation dragged out. In 2002, they did DNA tests on the record for the singular purpose of proving or disproving factual innocence in this matter. The results came back negative, and they left me sitting there for 5 more years while they squabbled about
What does it mean that they were squabbling about? What does it mean, right? That it comes back negative. So who's
responsible? Well, they had already they did the DNA test in compliance with state law, and the state law itself says you cannot get the money if the test doesn't prove factual innocence. So it required a predetermination of the circumstances and facts of the case. They made that determination with the FBI watching, the state multi-agency joint task force. So they did this right in front of everybody, in writing in front of a federal judge who had issued an injunction preventing DNA testing in this case based on the probability of evidence tampering. She said no. When the FBI said we want a DNA test, the federal judge said no. The evidence has no credibility, but they found slides that had been under lock and key at the medical examiner's office since the night of the homicide.
Right.
The judge found that this evidence had been properly preserved and protected and allowed DNA testing under this one unique circumstance in compliance with the state law. The problem was is the amount of wrongdoing that was involved. They get the negative test. I think what they had hoped was it would come back positive, and they could say, well, this man was guilty. Maybe our officers and our staff were overzealous in pursuing this prosecution. But when it came back negative, it put them in a position to where there was a good possibility that they might go to prison for what they did. So they simply ignored it. And if it came up in the public, would simply point to my bad character at the time and say, well, what about this? What about that? He was involved in these other crimes. He smoked marijuana.
Right.
He was a petty criminal, and none of that being relevant at all to the DNA test. So they just left me sitting there until the Innocence Project in New York City got involved and came in and put a stop to it, got me in front of the Court of Criminal Appeals and put these issues on the table and made them deal with it.
It seems to me that would have been even a worse period what you've gone through is horrendous, and it seems like that must have been an even worse period to be going through, since here was clear evidence validating what you've been saying all along. You're an innocent man, and now, despite that, you're still sitting there and sitting there and sitting there. What was going through your head?
It was mostly anger and frustration. I believed that, okay, it's possible that this incident, these people in Oklahoma County, in Oklahoma City, maybe it was just that it was isolated. I know that all police officers and all prosecutors in America all obey the same master, the United States Supreme Court, and they set the tone for everybody. And I don't agree with that tone that they've set of get tough on crime, mandatory minimums, the racial disparities and the economic disparities of the people who have to go to court and face these charges. So I thought it was just that these guys were just the proverbial bad apples, and that with the government stepping in and in front of the public, that there would be honorable conduct. So I think that was probably the worst time of the whole experience, is that I finally had that opportunity to clear my name and go before the public and be able to look them in the eye with some degree of pride and confidence and say, it wasn't me, I told you it wasn't, and here's the evidence. But I sat there day after day after day, and then more evidence kept surfacing that the police had withheld. For example, the man who killed Pam Willis that night, when he broke into the home, he went in through the bedroom window, and when he did, he left all 8 fingerprints on the window when he opened it. They withheld that evidence. He stepped on Pam Willis's naked body and left a bloody footprint on her thigh. Mm. They withheld that. They withheld documentation that they had basically validated my alibi, even right. though it was a shaky alibi. It wasn't good. I was with other drug addicts drinking and doing drugs.
Right.
But, yeah, that was the most frustrating period after all I had witnessed and gone through that right. to have that opportunity.
And so you got out in May. When did the Innocence Project start working on your case?
Well, I'd been in contact with them since 1996. But the Innocence Project is a 301c nonprofit, and their mandate is simply to do post-conviction DNA testing
right.
to prove or disprove factual innocence. They are not defense attorneys.
That's right.
They don't come in and represent right. you as defense. They come in and right. they do this before the court
right.
and before the public right. and let the chips fall where they may. They couldn't get involved because they were being told, as were my private attorneys or you know, my state attorneys, that the evidence was either missing or destroyed or had been consumed in previous testing. And it turns out that that wasn't true,
mm-hmm.
that they were lying about it. So the Innocence Project couldn't get involved. In 2000 and 2001, when this thing broke open, they couldn't get involved because they had to have the consent of my attorneys.
Mm.
And my attorneys were stonewalling the Innocence Project at that point. But as I said earlier, there came a, I think it was 2003, 2004,
mm-hmm.
where they finally stepped in and said, look, we have his permission to proceed on this, and we're going to.
Right.
We don't like what's going on here.
Now, why were your attorneys stonewalling the Innocence Project?
I mentioned
he smiles.
Earlier. Well, as I said, I was running out of time. My appeals, I began to lose my appeals. Mm-hmm. I'd made it into the federal system.
Right.
And at that point, because of the way the law has been restructured regarding the appellate law, you have a finite time period within which to complete your appeals.
Right.
So I had maybe a year or two left to live. I go into the federal system, I get these new lawyers, and they go straight to the judge and tell the judge, we're going to do DNA testing to prove or disprove factual innocence in this case.
Mm.
And they did it without my permission, and I had to stand up in front of the judge and file a complaint and say, you're not going to do DNA testing. They were tampering with the evidence. Mm. So my attorneys tell the judge and the attorney general for the state of Oklahoma that they believed that I was not competent to make decisions in this matter.
Whoa.
Because they believed that this woman in particular would have never done anything like that because it would offend her sense of professional integrity or some nonsense. So there's a big fight in front of a federal judge about mm-hmm. my competency and whether or not they would have tampered with evidence and they thought I was crazy and mm-hmm. that everything was above board in the prosecution.
Right.
They didn't know it, but at the time we were having this argument in front of a federal judge, the FBI was coming through the back door because of the falsification of that record.
Mm.
And when they did, a man named Captain Byron Beauchel in the Oklahoma City Police Department was assigned by the chief to go down and have a look around and see what was going on. And it was pure coincidence the way this happened. But when he went into her office to have a look around, he discovered a large box of physical evidence behind her desk that the court seals had been broken,
mm.
the internal seals on various evidence items had been broken, and that there was clearly evidence missing and that the whole box was in disarray. And he writes in his reports that he became concerned when he checked the case number
right.
and found out that it was a death penalty case that had been tried three times.
Wow.
It was me.
Mm.
They caught her in the act of destroying the physical evidence in this case to prevent DNA testing, to stop me from clearing my name. So they caught her in the act of doing this.
So, Curtis, we were getting to the Innocence Project came in on what
right.
date, and then I know you were released May of 2007, and I want to get to that moment when you knew that you were
okay.
going home. Right. And so the Innocence Project came in. They were able to help move forward with the DNA testing. When did that testing come back finally? And then what was the process from that point to when you got to go home? And does somebody have a cell phone on by chance? Because I hear a buzz. No? No cell phones? Okay.
It's just your ears, Joanne.
It's just me buzzing. Okay. <That's right>. That happens sometimes.
Too much coffee.
Put down the coffee cup.
Curtis.
Well, as I said, the DNA testing was conducted in front of a federal judge in compliance with state law.
Right.
And the results came back in July of 2002. Those results were negative, and they left me sitting there.
Right.
My attorneys weren't doing their job. They had went and told a federal judge I was crazy, and the first thing that they discovered was that she was manipulating the evidence. Mm-hmm. They caught her in the act at that time of destroying the evidence.
Right.
The FBI got a hold of her initial records, and as part of the process of firing her, terminating her from that position, they ruled that she had, in fact, went back and falsified all of her records.
Oh, good.
So as to incriminate me,
right,
having been previously eliminated.
Right.
So the Innocence Project finally becomes involved. They still won't let me go. They discover evidence that led them to believe that they were, in fact, withholding a fingerprint file. So we went to the judge on that.
Right.
They surrendered that material, some of it.
Mm-hmm.
They palm printed me and footprinted me right there in court.
Mm-hmm.
It's not me. They still don't let me go. They discover that some fingernail clippings from the crime scene. They do a DNA test on those. Not me.
Right.
So the Innocence Project finally compels the judge to dismiss the indictment and to set me free after those 22 years of wrongful incarceration. And I wish I could say to you and to your listeners that that was a happy day, but it wasn't.
Mm.
I couldn't find anything that day to celebrate.
Mm.
I mean, it was a joy that I can't express to be able, after 22 years, to finally hug my mother and my father and to be with them. And I couldn't have been more grateful for that and to share in their happiness.
Mm-hmm.
But for me and for my friends and my family, my community, for
mm-hmm.
Pam Willis.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing to celebrate that day.
Mm.
Pam lost her life. It wasn't a suicide or an accident. She was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And her government abandoned her.
Mm.
They went into court and they lied, knowing that if they did that, they would abandon this prosecution forever and they would never find the real perpetrator.
Right.
So she was betrayed. I was betrayed. I wish I could say that it was, you know, one of those days of joy and celebration, but it wasn't.
So I want you, listening audience, to get in on this conversation by giving us a call at 503-231-8187. I want to take a moment. First, I want to say thank you, Curtis. I really appreciate your honesty and just, you know, sharing your story because, you know, we talked to a lot of people that say, I was an upstanding citizen, and they just came and did me wrong.
Right. Yeah.
So I appreciate you just putting it out there, who you were at the time, and then what's happened over those 22 years. But I want to take a moment and talk to Ron about the Oregonians for the Alternatives to the Death Penalty. I know that we've heard over the years, you know, every once in a while we'll hear an Innocent Project story about somebody who's been on death row and was this close to being executed, and then we find out that they, in fact, were innocent of the crime. And so tell us a little bit, Ron, about the organization that you are volunteer with.
I volunteer with OADP, Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. It's one of the organizations around the country. Most every state has such an organization that's mm-hmm. trying to engage in activities that educate the public about things like Curtis's story.
Mm-hmm.
As compelling, as dramatic mm-hmm. as Curtis's story is, and he told it very honestly and articulated it very well, it's not totally unique.
Mm.
The death penalty system in our country, where there are 35 states have a death penalty, is flawed to the point that there are, at this moment in time, 134 other Curtis McCarty cases. 135 people have been exonerated since 1997, indicating a mistake by the system that we all allegedly trust in.
Right.
And I'm not saying that everybody in the criminal justice system is bad. Far from it. Most of the people that work in criminal justice system are very good people doing the right things. But there are mistakes made. Mm-hmm. We are humans, and those people sometimes for the wrong motives make mistakes, such as is Curtis's case.
Right.
It begs the question of if that many mistakes have been made, how many people have been executed before they had a chance, before they had an opportunity to prove their innocence? In the state of Oregon, there are presently 31 people on death row. We've only had two executions in the last two decades, and both of those people lost hope and gave up their appeals and virtually volunteered to be executed. Mm. For whatever God grace gave Curtis, he had the hope and the tenacity to stay with it and did not lose all hope. And that's part of what we do, is try and encourage those people to have hope, to try and correct the mistakes, to try and educate the public. In Oregon, it's a little more complex than other places. I worked on the campaign in New Mexico, where the law, the repeal of the death penalty, happened because of legislative action. In Oregon, it has to become changed because of a vote of the people.
Uh-huh. So it's a constitutional change. So if people wanted to contact Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, they could go to your website at oadp.org. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Excellent. We've got some callers on the line, so let's get the listening audience into this conversation. Good morning, John. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was wondering, these guys, do they get any shot at suing these people for wrongful incarceration?
That's a really good question. You know, I was thinking of that, but then I got sidetracked.
I mean, it's just a thing where, oh, gee, sorry we locked you up, and then poof, your life is, you know, what could you have done in 18 years, you know?
22 years. So, Curtis, that's a really good question. So is there an opportunity for you to be compensated for 22 lost years of your life by the state of Oklahoma?
For me, actually, there is. For most people, there is not, whether it's a death row exoneration. There's simply not that many mechanisms in place, and the hurdles that have to be leapt in order to show malicious prosecution. Mm-hmm. You can go to the Innocence Project's website, and they keep data on all of the states and their compensation policies and how they're applied to their citizens. I am, in fact, scheduled to go to jury trial on October 12th on federal civil rights violations lawsuits.
Excellent.
Despite being in a unique position of being able to do that, I am not particularly enamored of the process. Mm-hmm. I don't care. It's not going to solve anything. It doesn't undo what they did to me or Pam Willis.
That's right.
And it doesn't stop
it. It gives you some resources to carry on if you want to.
That's true. It you know, I don't. I did lose a lot of wages. I lost. You know, those things in life that many of us take for granted as we get older. We buy a home and we build up equity, and we have insurance, and we have we build up seniority in our jobs. And I lost all that stuff, which I can never get back because of that lost time. But yeah, compensation.
Well, in the process of finding these wrongful incarcerations, do you guys find that majority of them are like yours?
That's a good question. We're going to allow him to answer that after you hang up. Thank you so much for your call.
Okay.
We appreciate it. Have a great day. Thank you. And so what's I know for you, Curtis, it's like it's been all about what your experience has been, right? And so I don't want to put you in a position of answering for all the other people who have found themselves on death row and then ultimately are found to be innocent. And so I'm hoping, Vaughn, that you can actually kind of help us expand on the Innocent Project's work. And so is there an do we have data that shows just, you said there's 135 other people who've had a total that the Innocent Project has found to be innocent. But those are people that are alive, right?
They weren't all helped by the Innocence Project. The Innocence Project is vital to many of them, but through various means, DNA is just one of them. It's not the major one.
Right.
Most of the sentences were overturned because of prosecutorial misconduct. People that they got to be witnesses have recanted, right. Snitches in prison. The case that's prominent in the news today is one down in Georgia.
That's right.
Where
six of the seven witnesses have recanted.
Yeah, seven of the nine witnesses have recanted, and they're ready to execute this man. And finally, the Supreme Court has said, we're going to take a look at this, hold up on that execution.
That's right.
The other case that's prominent in the news today is the Willingham case in Texas. He was executed in 2004, and there's been a continuing study, and the New Yorker magazine did a major story, and it's been publicized quite a bit, and there's pretty conclusive evidence that he was innocent and has been executed, and we have no idea how many other people have. But one of the things that I think addresses your question is, in most states, the state has to pay for the defense as well as the prosecution. And it's a costly particular project.
Right.
In most cases, the funds available for the defense nowhere near equate what the prosecution has. Mm-hmm. So we have an imbalance in terms of the justice system, in terms of hiring investigators and expert witnesses and doing specific testing. So that's one of the things that's flawed about the death penalty. And we just think that the costs are too high when we're talking about life and death, people's death, to be making these mistakes. There are other ways to punish people who have committed violent crimes, and that's to separate them from the population. We don't need to kill them. And it just says so much about our society, and we'd like to rectify those situations so that those mistakes are not made. None of us are soft on crime. But what we are vehement about and passionate about is not making mistakes and having a system that is so flawed, and to continue that way.
And so, Curtis McCarthy, you have quite a lineup of activities that you're going to be involved in while you're here. You're leaving here, and then you're headed to Salem, and then I believe it's Eugene, where there's a film tonight. And so you're having this whirlwind Oregon tour during the time that you're here. So you want to tell listening audiences, our listening audience, kind of where they can connect with Curtis later today?
Yeah, I'll answer that since we pretty much put his schedule together. He just flew in late last night.
I forgot he told me. He just goes where you tell him to go, right?
Yeah, he's been very gracious about that. And our next stop is down at McLaren Juvenile Correction Facility. And there are a lot of people there who are in trouble, maybe for minor things. And Curtis just explained how he admits that he was not the most upstanding young man.
That's right.
And he's got a very powerful message, and they're eager to have him talk to those people down there and let them know you keep making a bad name for yourself, terrible things can happen.
Could happen. That's right.
It becomes a matter of life and death. And then this afternoon, we're going to tape a TV show at the Salem Community cable television station, and then tonight it is in Salem, not in Eugene, at the Grand Theater at 7 p.m. There'll be a showing of The Exonerated. It's a powerful movie with some very big stars, Susan Sarandon, Brian Dennehy, about six people who were on death row and exonerated. And then Curtis will speak after to that group. That's a part of the Salem Progressive Film Series. Once a month they do things like this. And we're very pleased that Curtis can come in and be our featured speaker and lead the discussion following the movie tonight. So it's a packed day. We're going to get our money's worth out of Curtis.
Well, that's going to be a really powerful evening. And I know we have a lot of listeners from the Salem area. And so hopefully there'll be a standing room only crowd tonight, and I know that the youth at McLaren definitely need to hear this story over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So let me say something about something that we haven't talked about today. We know that our criminal justice system is totally overrepresented internally by people of color and poor people. And what we know is that death row reflects that. One of the questions that someone said to me when they knew we were doing this show is, do we have any idea how many people we've actually killed because they didn't have the resources to continue to do appeals, they didn't have the education level to understand how to fight the system? Do we have any kind of grasp on how many people that were innocent actually are no longer with us because they were tried supposedly by a jury of their peers and found to be guilty?
Curtis may have something to add, but I'd like to try and answer that question. The direct answer is no. There's no way to be sure. Mm-hmm. But there is evidence in several cases. The Willingham case is the one that becomes pretty clear, but there are other cases. The Ruben Costa case in Texas, the Carlos de Luna case in Texas, the Larry Griffin case in Missouri. Sister Helen Prejean, who wrote Dead Man Walking, also wrote a book, Death of Innocence, where she profiled the O'Dell and the Gilliam case. And one of those people in her book concludes that one was probably guilty, the other was probably innocent. Mm. We don't know for sure, but when we have 135 mistakes that have been unearthed,
right.
There's a pretty good indication there today. And then to your other question about poor and people of color, there's about 3,300 plus people on death rows across the country in federal prisons in the 35 states that have the death row, have the death penalty. 42% of them, compared to a population of maybe 15%, mm-hmm. are people of color. Mm. No matter what color they are, they're all poor, and they have to rely on that public defense, mm-hmm. which I mentioned earlier is not the equivalent. When we look at the scales of justice, that mm-hmm. image that we have, the mm-hmm. scales of justice are not even. Mm-hmm. So the poor people are the ones that go. Sister Helen uses the terms, there's the OJs and the NoJs. People with money, there are no rich people on death row.
That's right.
So it's flawed in that way. Mm-hmm. It's also unfair and biased geographically. Mm-hmm. Because many of the district attorneys, and Macy might be the prime example, are elected officials, and many of them get elected because they want to be tough on crime.
Right.
You can commit the exact same crime in one county and have an aggressive district attorney who wants to keep getting elected, and then the same crime happens in the county next to it, and the district attorney does not have that same compassion or that same compelling reason. And so it's really a very, very mixed system that is unfair. It's biased tremendously, and we need to get rid of it.
Thank you. Curtis, do you want to add to that before I go back to the phone line?
No, that was a good answer.
That was good. You like that, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first, let me tell you what's coming up today on KBOO. Teresa Mitchell's Press Watch will not be heard this morning, but still, we will still bring you news and analysis of swine flu, climate change, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, on Between the Lines. At 9:30, Linda Olsen Osterlund speaks again with Robert King, one of the Angolian Three, on A Deeper Look. At 10, Air Cascadia, commentary and headlines with Chris Andrea and Liam Delta. At 10:15, you'll hear Flashpoints Investigative News with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, Lynn Mollick talks with Todd Davies, author of Jam Today. And at 11:30, Bill and Conch take you inside the world of words and pictures on your community-powered radio, KBOO 90.7, or, of course, online at www.kbOO.fm. So we're going to go back to the phone line now. Good morning, caller.
Bart.
Good morning, Bart. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Great conversation, great discussion. I can only offer, you know, small condolences to your main guest. I mean, he got screwed, and that's really the mm-hmm. the bottom line. The last comment about the anti-death penalty person saying that, you know, one DA may have a higher need to be aggressively prosecuting and another may not. Part of that is the funding of elections.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is the lack of oversight, I think, which has been demonstrated here, that there are a few consequences on a local level for prosecutorial misconduct. And they can comment on that if they'd like after I'm done. The other small thing I'd like to say is your willingness to go forward into the community and go to McLaren and places like that is really quite outstanding. That certainly this is a message that a lot of people need to hear, even people that aren't already afoul of the system.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those places where, you know, if you haven't done anything wrong, you don't have anything to fear. You know, that argument that so many on the right like to say about people who are wanting more controls on police and prosecutors. Well, gee, if you haven't done anything wrong, you know, why not stop? Why not submit to a search? Why not give us your information?
Right.
That's sometimes has terrible consequences. But I wonder if it might be possible for them to videotape his discussion down at McLaren so that it could maybe go into the library that they might have for people not so lucky to be seeing him in person. And I'll just take the rest of this off the air.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the call. That's a great idea. And actually, you said Salem Community Media is taping a program.
Yeah, we're going to have two opportunities. Program that Curtis and I are going to do at Community Cable in Salem will be available on their channel repeatedly over the next month. There probably, or quite possibly, will be a taping at McLaren, but that will only be used for that purpose, that they have given us the assurances that they have other people that they would like to see it.
Right.
They're presently there and maybe come in the future, but they are not going to show it anywhere else, and we don't want that kind of thing to get on the internet,
right.
That kind of thing. But it's certainly an appropriate message for those young people down there who need the help.
Absolutely. I agree with that. I think that, you know, therefore, but for the grace of God, go I, right? I mean, a whole lot of kids are going to see themselves in you when you tell your story at McLaren. So I think it's wonderful to have that opportunity.
Yeah, Bart mentioned about the lack of oversight and the lack of really punishing those who have really breached the public trust in about the most severe way possible. I'm one curious, Curtis, is anything happening to these individuals that were involved in your case where there was such horrible misconduct? Is there any indication there may be prosecution of these individuals at all, or
no?
But they're still investigating, did you say?
Yeah, but as I pointed out, they had a felony crime right off the bat. That's what started the investigation: the falsification of a federal document in a death penalty case.
Right.
And the only thing that has happened thus far is that Joyce Gilchrist was fired. None of the other people who collaborated with her or who encouraged it, it seems that the people of Oklahoma have forgotten that Joyce Gilchrist had neither motive nor authority to do any of these things to any of the men. It's not just me. There are actually 196 cases under active investigation right now in which Joyce Gilchrist was the only witness against that person.
Whoa.
She touched over 2,000 cases. Testified in over 600, and 196 were identified as resting solely on her word.
Testimony.
So far, two of those cases have been dealt with, Jeffrey Todd Pierce and me. All other records remain sealed, confidential. The Justice Department won't discuss the matter because it's an ongoing investigation. There's been no accountability, no exposure. There's no transparency. No one knows what's going on. And
sounds like a great class action lawsuit for some attorney in Oklahoma who could overnight have 194 new clients.
Thank you very much. That's the very message I have been delivering.
That's right. You are very welcome. It's like, yeah, you know, you don't have to have a law degree to know that that's a good client base there. Well, Curtis, I mean, what's happened to you since you've been out? I mean, you've reconnected with your family. Tell us what that's like. What else are you doing, and how are you, like, moving forward beyond this horrific experience?
Ron and I were talking about that in the car on the way over, how this evolved, that I ended up in Portland
today.
You know, how did that happen? I spent a lot of time in prison, you know, trying to mature and to become a better person and to educate myself, to pick up where I had left off, you know, as a teenager when I started taking drugs. But I think, you know, near the end, in those last 7 years or so, the pressure just became too much, and I started having a lot of problems and becoming, you know, going off in the opposite direction, becoming antisocial again and a bit grumpy about all of this. So I got out, and I didn't have contact with anybody other than my family and my attorneys and social worker at the Innocence Project. So they thought it would be a good idea to get me out of the House. Mm-hmm. So they proposed sending me to Nebraska to testify before their state legislature on a pending bill to abolish the death penalty.
Right.
I declined.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't think that I could handle this, mm-hmm. Having to face this and face people.
Mm-hmm.
So they collaborated with my mother, and next thing I know, I'm on a plane to Lincoln. So one thing led to another.
Right.
The visit went really well, mm-hmm. and that's where they first gave me the opportunity. They thought it would be a good idea,
mm-hmm.
to, for example, to go to the Youth Dissension Center and talk to those young men and women.
Right.
And that's how that part of these engagements was first born. It went well. I don't like it. It's mm-hmm. it's difficult to talk about, mm-hmm. and to talk about the men who died and
mm-hmm.
and the people who suffer, the mm-hmm. families involved.
Mm-hmm.
I was never oblivious to that. Every time, for example, in court, every time that I turned around and saw my mother sitting there crying,
mm-hmm.
and just right across the aisle was Pam Willis's mother doing the same thing. They both lost a family member.
That's right.
I never forgot those things. I worry about it constantly, about the integrity of the system and that the suffering that comes not just to the victims but to the perpetrator's family, even for the men who did it. Their mm-hmm. families have to deal with that, and
that's
they're
right.
Being ostracized in their communities. But so it went well.
Curtis,
and here
I want
to
know how you are, though. I mean, how are you? I mean, yeah, your mom is making you go around and do all these talking, and you're actually connecting with young people to let them know this is like this horrible tale of what's possible, even if you're just doing stupid stuff, right? Because we know in Oregon with mandatory minimums that stupid stuff can get you a long prison sentence. But how are you, Curtis the man? You've been free for a couple of years, just trying to get your feet under you. How are you? You don't know. Okay. I will stop putting pressure on you to tell me how you are.
Back off, Joanne.
I will
off.
Back off. But what I want the listening audience to know is what I see is a confident man who smiles easily and who is about justice, not just for himself, but for other people out there that don't have justice. So that's what I see.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, in that respect, I'm okay. I understand what the situation is and the need to talk to people about this,
right.
and just have an open and honest dialogue about it. And hopefully that there will be, change in all our communities.
That's right.
Better policies toward these kids who are messing up instead of just slamming them in, behind bars.
Right.
But anyway, yeah.
I think that's really the message. I mean, there used to be a time that you could be a kid and do stupid things, and it didn't have the kind of severe consequences that they had for you or they have for many youth in Oregon because of our mandatory minimum sentence. And so it used to be a time being a kid was like, okay, because you could be stupid and you could redeem yourself from being stupid.
Right. Joyriding, for example.
Yeah, joyriding,
It doesn't
example.
Exist anymore. It's now Grand Theft Auto.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so I want to once again make sure people know how they can connect with you during the short time that you're here, and also want to give you an invitation to come back to Oregon. You don't have to wait for Ron. You can just connect with Dave or I, and we'll get you connected to folks and have you come on back to Portland and Oregon. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure hearing your story and hearing the resiliency that actually can come from your life experience. So thank you. And so, Ron, I want to give you an opportunity, if you can go through the list again, what's all going to be going on over the next day?
Okay, quickly. I can't answer your question to Dave about, or Curtis about how he is, but
right.
I know what he's doing now is a very valuable community service. He's
Absolutely.
Helping to educate the population
That's right.
about the truth in
That's
our
right.
criminal justice system
That's
and
right.
the death penalty today. And we thank you for the opportunity to be here with you and talk to your listeners. We're going down to McLaren. That's obviously a private session, and then we'll be taping a program that will show on Salem Community Television,
Media.
Cable television, over the next month or so.
Yeah.
And then tonight at 7 o'clock, the Grand Theater, downtown Salem, will be the showing of The Exonerated, where Curtis will be talking following that show.
And I want to once again give people the website for Oregonians for the Alternative to the Death Penalty. That's OADP. KBOL.org, and we also have that on...
We do. We have that online at KBOO.fm/Voices from the Edge. We also have the listing for what's going on at the film festival tonight, so folks can just log on to that as well and get all the specifics, time and location and what have you.
Yeah, I think if they go to our site, there's also links to things like the Innocence Project, the Murder Victims Family for Reconciliation, other organizations across the country, National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, that people can learn more about it. And that's all we're doing in our community organizing, get people to really understand the facts and then make a decision. We think they'll fall down on the side of being against the death penalty.
And on the side of justice and equality, right, for
Absolutely.
Everyone in our community, one of the things that I continue to learn over and over and over again is that we have to have the real life stories, because if we keep having a philosophical conversation about the need to fix our criminal justice system, we never get anywhere. But there's nothing more compelling than the personal stories that say, and this is why we need to make change happen. So I am Joanne Bowman.
And I'm Dave Mazza.
And we actually do have another minute or so, and we have one caller on the phone, so yeah. We're going to try to get them.
I was wondering
in
what was going on here.
Well, you know, Rich is really famous for studying my music. Oh, we lost that caller. Well, again, I just want to say that this has been a very informative program for me, and I'm hoping that, you know, lots of folks come out in Salem this evening and hear the program. Check our website, and also you can stream on KBOO's Voices from the Edge website off the KBOO site. So have a great day. Joanne Bowman.
Dave Mazza.
See you next week, same time, same channel.